Today is Tuesday, September 26. We have two topics today, blood pressure regulation and bulk fluid transport at the capillary. All right, so on page 53, we're going to be talking about blood pressure. And I just want to mention that the number one influence over blood pressure is what? Cardiac output. Yeah, so the amount of blood that you're circulating is the number one influence over your blood pressure. Let's think big picture here, because back in an earlier chapter when we covered the blood information, you know, we talked about blood being approximately 5 liters in the average body, and a little more than half of that blood is what?
Plasma.
Good. So we're looking at around 55% of your blood volume being made up of plasma, around 45 or so being composed of formed elements, right? And most of that 45% is what? Which particular formed element?
Red blood cells.
Good. So right now, this given moment, you probably can't do a whole lot to change your erythrocyte count. But, you know, your blood volume can change based on your hydration status. You know, your kidneys are constantly filtering blood, removing the waste products and fluids from your bloodstream for cleansing. And so, you know, we can see a fluctuation in your blood volume specifically based on how much plasma you're circulating. So each of those plasma and formed elements can influence your overall cardiac output. But the more influential one is most likely that plasma component, since you can change the volume of fluids that you take in to increase your cardiac output. So let's hang on to the thoughts about cardiac output and shift our attention to peripheral resistance. That is also an influence over blood pressure. It's not as important as cardiac output, but there are certainly some things here that can influence pressure. So peripheral resistance, let's just break those two words down. Peripheral, where does that sound like? Kind of outside. So we're not talking about resistance around the heart. We're talking about resistance away from the heart. So we're looking at resistance to blood flow in your vessels, such as the ones in your arms and legs, your abdomen, so to speak. All right, and then what is resistance?
Going against,
yeah. So we're looking at what goes against blood flow in those peripheral vessels. Okay, these are some things that can reduce the blood pressure or influence that blood pressure. Let's talk about these three types of peripheral resistance. We've got blood viscosity, vessel length, and vessel diameter. Let's take blood viscosity first. All right, so we just kind of talked about this. We know blood is composed of two main items, blood plasma and formed elements. Which one makes up the majority of your blood?
Plasma.
Plasma, right. So if you're dehydrated, how does that change the ratio between plasma and formed elements?
It lessens.
So you've got more
formed elements,
yeah, more red blood cells. So, you know, we know that hydration status, how much you've had to drink, how effective your kidneys are at removing fluids from your bloodstream, those kinds of things can alter the amount of blood plasma you carry. All right, so then, of course, there's the other issue here of formed elements. The most common formed element is which one? The red blood cell. Good. So it makes up, you know, the majority of those formed elements that we circulate. So if you increase the number of red blood cells in circulation, we have a condition now called polycythemia. Yeah. And if you decrease the number of red blood cells in circulation, we have
anemia.
Good. So do you think that changing your white blood cell population is going to greatly influence your blood viscosity?
No.
Why not?
Because it only counts for like 1% at most.
1%, yes. So white blood cell population has very little influence. How about platelet numbers? Is that going to change your blood viscosity? Not really. Yeah, so we're looking at 1% buffy coat for white blood cells and platelets. That really plays very little role in your overall blood viscosity. So the two main influences here on blood viscosity is how much fluid you're circulating in the plasma and then how many red blood cells you're circulating, okay? So I want you to think about milkshakes. That's going to be a tempting treat for us to think about during our conversation for blood. If you have really thick milkshakes to drink, then in terms of having to pull that through a drinking straw, how much work do you have to do? Yeah, do a lot of work to get that to move. So likewise, if you happen to have really thick blood being moved through your vessels, how hard does your heart have to work?
Very hard.
Very hard, yeah. So if your heart is working harder to move thicker blood, what happens to your blood pressure?
It goes up.
Goes up, yeah. So not only will you see an increase in heart rate, you'll also see an increase in blood pressure when you're trying to move really thick blood. Okay? So what conditions might give you thicker blood?
Polycythemia.
Extreme dehydration.
Good, extreme dehydration. Right. So those are some things that will increase your blood viscosity or thickness and mean that your blood pressure and heart rate have to increase to make sure that we maintain delivery of oxygen to our cells and tissues. Good.
Would diabetes insipidus cause this?
Probably, yeah, because you're going to be losing fluids, and that's extreme dehydration. Yep, good. That's good thinking out of the box. Those are test questions. That's good. Okay, our second type of peripheral resistance has to do with your vessel length. And so if you think about your vessels, we travel away from the heart in the aorta. The aorta gives rise to smaller vessels called arteries. They branch into arterioles and they branch into capillaries. And every time you branch, what happens to the diameter? I was going to give you a hint there, but what happens to the diameter?
It
gets smaller. Okay. If you add miles of length to that, okay, then now you have not only smaller branching vessels, but many more miles of vessel to transport this blood through. So the simple fact that if you have extra pounds to carry around, you need extra blood vessels to nourish that body tissue. And so the longer the length of those vessels, and considering the fact that they do get smaller in diameter, the further they get from your heart, then the heart has to work even harder. So if you've ever heard the old thing of, you know, if somebody's overweight, they often recommend losing weight as a way to help reduce blood pressure. What is the science behind that?
Less surface area, the less likely your blood vessels have to stretch out more.
Yeah, the less you've got, the less you have to serve, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the science behind losing weight to reduce blood pressure. So the longer the vessels, the harder the heart works, the higher the blood pressure has to be to accommodate delivery out to all those cells and tissues. I kind of think of it like this. If you live in a spread out area and the mailman has to drive 100 miles to deliver your mail, that's a lot of work, right? So if you've got blood to be delivered far from the heart, there has to be a hard push behind that blood to get it out to all your cells and tissues. Okay, right now, if I said to you, can you change your blood viscosity right now? Can you?
Mm-hmm.
Right now you can lose weight?
Right now.
Okay. So right now, can you change your blood viscosity?
Not
really. And of course, you know, I'd love to say, okay, we're going to drop 20, right? And there we go.
Mm-hmm.
Not happening.
No.
Okay, and so the only thing you can do right now is to influence your blood vessel diameter. The way you can change your blood vessel diameter is simply by standing up. And that's all you have to do to change your blood vessel diameter. So of all three items here listed under peripheral resistance, the one thing that you can influence and change over a very short period of time is vessel diameter. All right, so if you're sitting relaxed, and I hope you're not stressed out sitting here, if you're relaxed, when you stand up, and if you were to do so quickly, blood is going to pool in your lower extremities. Thank you, gravity. Okay? And so if you stood up very quickly, your body's going to have to work to get that blood up to your head. If you stand up quickly, you may experience a little bit of orthostatic hypotension. Hypotension meaning what? Low blood pressure. Right. And then how do you feel if you have orthostatic hypotension? Dizzy, lightheaded, feel like you're going to black out, a little bit of tunnel vision there. Okay, and the older we get, the more likely it is we experience that because our vessels can't accommodate and change vessel diameter. So by standing up, you can actually experience the effects of vessels changing their diameter. If you want to increase blood pressure upon standing, what should happen to your vessel's diameter? Constrict them. How will constricting your vessels help you when you stand? What will it do to blood pressure?
Keeps it from rising.
Yeah, keeps it up so that way you can still push out blood and deliver it. Right. Now, if you stood up and your vessels did the opposite thing, if your vessels actually dilated upon standing, what would happen to your blood pressure? Bottom out. Yeah, you'd black out, you would pass out. Your blood pressure would be too low to deliver oxygen to your brain.
Okay. So when they constrict, they're kind of working against gravity when they stand up.
They are working against gravity, yeah. And old people who stand up really quick and take medications to lower blood pressure, if they don't stand there before they start to move, they can often pass out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're all headed there.
I'm ready.
Okay, so let me talk to you about ways to control blood pressure. This comes from your next page, that should be 54. So just going back to review for a moment, we know the number one influence over blood pressure is cardiac output. We're going to leave that aside for just a moment, instead focus here on peripheral resistance. Of these three items, blood viscosity, vessel length, and vessel diameter, what is the one thing that you can change immediately?
Vessel diameter.
Good. So let's kind of focus in on that. And I'm going to take it to page 54. And we're going to put that under what's called neural control. Okay? That's going to fall under neural control. So I'd like to show you a picture of this. This is a picture of your brain in a relationship with the heart. So where's the medulla oblongata located?
Underneath the
pons. Underneath the pons. Okay. So we're looking down here in the brain stem area. And that brain stem area, specifically the medulla oblongata, is home to a control center. Back in Bio 210, you may have learned about some of those control centers housed in your medulla. The medulla houses like a vomiting center. We're not going to worry about that right now. It houses a cardiovascular center, and that is the one we want to focus on. So because it's called a cardiovascular center, it has a control center for both heart and for
vessels.
Good. So we know the heart has its own built-in pacemaker. So this is not really a pacemaker that we're looking at in the medulla. This is more of an override control. So, you know, if you stand up quickly and you need blood to go to your brain, then this medulla oblongata is going to be able to give feedback to our vessels and to our heart to make sure that we can maintain blood pressure. So we're going to talk about that cardiovascular center. The vasomotor center is actually a piece of that cardiovascular center. And vasomotor gives you a clue. What does that mean?
It means the movement of your vessels. How do your vessels regulate your dilator?
Yeah, regulates your blood pressure. It's how the vessels move. And so it's either going to cause your vessels to constrict or to relax. Yeah. I do want to mention that because it's called the cardiovascular center, we also include a cardiac portion in here. So it's kind of a tag team approach. If we increase blood pressure through vasoconstriction, guess what we do to the heart at the very same time? increase the SA note, yes, so increase heart rate, increase blood pressure. So we're going to find that the cardiovascular center works together like a tag team, telling your vessels and your heart how to accommodate for changes in your body. Because our focus is largely on the vessels right now, let me emphasize this. There is sympathetic innervation to your vessels, but there is no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. This is one of those really important rules that you may want to highlight, underline, stick on a flashcard. There is sympathetic innervation to your vessels, but there is no parasympathetic innervation. Imagine this. Imagine the brakes fell on your car. Uh-oh. Be even worse if you lived in the mountains, right? Okay, so you only have a gas pedal, so I have the option of either stepping on the gas and speeding up my car, or if I want to slow down, what must I do? You get an emergency brake? Let's say that's gone too. Take your foot off the gas pedal. Okay, so that's how blood vessels work. You either step on the gas, increasing sympathetic stimulation, or you take your foot off the gas, decreasing sympathetic stimulation, and causing your vessels to do what?
Relax.
Relax, right. So I kind of think of this setup for your blood vessels kind of like a car without brakes. You can either speed it up through stepping on the gas pedal, that is sympathetic stimulation, or you can simply take your foot off the gas, let your vessels relax. That's about the only way you can get your vessel diameter to dilate. Does that make sense? Okay. So you know, this is not a quick thing. If you happen to increase your sympathetic stimulation, you know, to increase your blood pressure, in order to relax your vessels, you're having to look at 30 minutes or more for a complete relaxation of those vessels. So it's not like, boom, I constrict, and 2 minutes later, I'm completely relaxed. This is why, you know, oftentimes when we're ready to go to sleep, we have to kind of de-escalate, we have to relax a little bit, and eventually our blood pressure drops. So it's not something that happens immediately. It's something that we have to wait for over time. So if you stay, you know, push to the edge up until bedtime, it's going to take you even longer to de-escalate and relax before you can go to sleep. So kind of the same concept there. We have to let those vessels dilate through a lack of sympathetic stimulation. Okay, so your vasomotor center is located where?
Medulla oblongata.
Medulla oblongata, good. And that vasomotor center is going to respond to your emotional state. If you're excited and stressed out, so is your vasomotor center. Does that turn off or turn on sympathetic stimulation?
Turn on.
Turns it on. So you stay ramped up, blood pressure is high, heart rate increases. We also get feedback from baroreceptors and chemoreceptors. Baro as a prefix is pressure. Chemo as a prefix is chemical. And so baroreceptors and chemoreceptors tell your vasomotor center what's going on in your body. They're like tattletales. And so they run to your brain and they say, hey brain, blood pressure's not good enough. Would the baroreceptor pick up on that or the chemoreceptor?
Chemo.
If your blood pressure's not good enough? That's a baroreceptor, yeah. What about this? What about you're exercising and you're producing excess CO2? Now, that's a chemoreceptor, yeah. Chemochemistry, yeah. The three chemicals that your chemoreceptors detect are, they're no-brainers, right? Oxygen is a big one, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen ions. Why hydrogens?
Because pH level.
pH, good. I should tell you that these receptors, baro and chemo, are located in your aortic arch, sitting right there, and they're also in the common carotid arteries in your neck. Okay, so why is your common carotid artery a great place to put some receptors?
It's headed to your brain.
It's headed to your brain, yep. So that blood flow is headed to your brain. If there are problems with that blood, your brain is going to need to be fixed, of course, first. That's the most important organ we've got in terms of control. All right, so baroreceptors and chemoreceptors are located in your common carotid arteries and your aortic arch. So let me give you a feedback process here. By the way, this is negative feedback, and this is a way for us to accommodate for changes in your body and maintain blood pressure and heart rate to go along with it. Okay, so let's say that you're exercising and that you have increased levels of CO2. What type of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptors.
Good. These arrows here show chemoreceptors sitting in your aortic arch, feeding back information to your cardiovascular center. It's found in what part of your brain? Medulla oblongata. Good. Like any control center, the medulla oblongata says, "Ooh, thank you, tattletales. You've told me that you've got extra CO2. Excess CO2 can be harmful to our bodies, so we need to get rid of it more quickly." And so there's a feedback mechanism that now turns on. You'll notice these arrows here come back from your medulla oblongata to your SA node and also to your arterioles. They're the primary ones we can control diameter for. Should we tell that we're going to increase sympathetic stimulation to those locations or decrease sympathetic stimulation?
Increase.
Increase. How is that going to help fix our initial problem? Exchange that CO2 faster, right? So we're leaving out a part here, right? We're leaving out what the lungs are going to do, but the lungs, of course, are going to also want to expire out that excess CO2. The way you get the blood to the lungs faster is to simply increase heart rate and increase blood pressure. So we do that by increasing sympathetic stimulation. What do we tell our SA node?
To fire more often.
Fire more often. And so what happens to your heart rate?
It goes up.
It goes up. And in order to circulate blood more quickly, we need higher pressure. And we accomplish that by doing what?
Constricting your vessels.
Constricting your vessels, right. So that's a response to a problem that we can fix through a negative feedback loop. If you have excess CO2, simply have your cardiovascular center increase sympathetic stimulation. Makes sense so far? Anything I can clarify for you? Let's do another one. Okay, we live at sea level for the most part, right? We're like 100 feet above sea level. If you go up into the mountains, let's say you pick a really high mountain, one that's 10,000 feet tall, and now you're going to walk around this really high mountain that has a very low oxygen content in the air. Now your bloodstream has low oxygen levels. Okay, so once again, blood traveling through the aortic arch and the common carotids in your neck are going to have low oxygen levels. What kind of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptors.
Chemoreceptors are tattletales. They run to your brain, they tell your cardiovascular center and your medulla oblongata. What decision does your cardiovascular center make? We need more oxygen, right? Increase sympathetic, right. So what happens to your SA node?
Fires
more quickly. Good. And of course your blood vessels will constrict. And the piece we're leaving out of the conversation is
the lungs.
So we got to circulate this blood to the lungs more quickly to pick up
more oxygen.
Yep. So, which neurotransmitters tell your SA node to fire faster and tell your vessels to constrict.
Epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Epinephrine and norepinephrine, right. Okay. Sounds pretty common sense like, right? Okay, you go in the mountains, your heart's beating out of your chest, you're doing this because you're trying to get more oxygen, you know, and that's a way for your cardiovascular center to accommodate for the lack of oxygen in that air. Let's do another one. Let's say that you're exercising and you are in lactic acidosis. That is my problem. Acidosis means that we have too many hydrogen ions. All right, so now what kind of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptors.
Good, and where are they located?
In the AR and the common drive.
Good, they're tattletales. What do they tell the brain? You're in acidosis. The brain says, I'm going to fix this problem by doing what?
Firing the SA node.
Good. Tell the SA node to speed it up and tell your blood vessels to constrict. And so when you're in lactic acidosis, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure increases. So again, the piece we're leaving out of the puzzle is the lungs. And eventually you breathe off that excess acid as CO2. So that's a piece we'll pick up a little bit later. All right, let's do another one. Let's say that we have a person who had too many antacids and they had a really bad stomach ache, so they took a bunch of Alka-Seltzers and some Tums. These antacids made the bloodstream become too alkaline. Now we have the opposite problem. If you caused sympathetic stimulation for acidosis, what are you going to do for alkalosis?
Parasympathetic for the heart.
Good. Okay. So alkalosis means you have too few hydrogen ions. And so you're right. The message comes back from your cardiovascular center to your SA node. This time the message says, hey, SA node, slow down. And so you're right, that's parasympathetic innervation. And which neurotransmitter do we use?
Acetylcholine,
right. So acetylcholine will tell your SA node and your AV nodes actually to fire more slowly. So heart rate will decrease. Now here's the catch. Is there any parasympathetic innervation to your vessels?
No.
No. So what do? How do you get your vessels to relax?
You decrease sympathetic.
Decrease sympathetic innervation to your vessels and give it enough time and those vessels will
dilate,
right? And when your vessels dilate, what happens to blood pressure?
It drops down,
exactly. So kind of a scary thought, isn't it? If you happen to have an overdose, maybe it's unintentional, of Alka-Seltzers and Tums, if you put yourself into a situation of alkalosis, you can actually cause your heart rate to drop, your blood pressure to bottom out, and that can cause some serious problems, right? So kind of a scary thought that, you know, an alkalosis situation like that can be induced from just taking too many antacids.
Standing up would be helpful.
Exercise, right? Okay, let's do a couple with baroreceptors. Let's say that we have somebody who has had a severe case of dehydration, and this person has lost a lot of fluids, and so the person's blood pressure is very, very low. Now, what type of receptor picks up on this information?
Baroreceptor.
Good. Where's the baroreceptor located?
Aorta and common carotid.
Good. Aorta and common carotid. And these baroreceptors signal back to the brain, and the brain here, cardiovascular center, says, we're going to fix this by doing what? Good. Fire that SA node faster. Do we use acetylcholine or epinephrine, norepinephrine?
Epinephrine.
Yeah, epinephrine and norepinephrine. Good. So your heart rate increases, and we're going to have a tag team approach here, right? So what do we also tell your blood vessels to do?
To constrict,
right. So if you've ever been really dehydrated, you'll notice that your heart rate increases, your blood vessels will constrict, and your blood pressure will also increase, okay? So that is a fix or a compensation for a problem, okay? So we're looking right now at how we fix problems using a negative feedback loop. Thinking about this whole mechanism, where is your control center?
Your brain,
good. What particular portion?
Medulla
oblongata, good. And what are some of the receptors that feed information to your brain?
Baro
and chemoreceptors, good. And here's one. What is the effector for the parasympathetic nervous system? What carries information to your heart?
Vagus nerve.
Good for you. Yeah, vagus nerve is the one that tells your heart rate to slow down. That means there is no vagus nerve innervation to what?
To the vessels.
Yeah, so kind of an interesting thought that the vagus nerve innervates your heart, but it doesn't innervate your vessels. Good. Okay, enough talk. Let me get you on to page 55. Let me give you a few minutes to complete as many of those practice problems as you can. I'll hit the lights for you. All right, let's hit answers there. That first one for high blood pressure is done for you, so we'll take the second problem. I've notated it is low blood pressure. That is your stimulus. All right, so what kind of receptor picks up on blood pressure problems?
Baroreceptors,
good. And then, of course, your control center is your cardiovascular center. It makes a decision to do what? Good. Increase sympathetic stimulation. You can also include it decreases parasympathetic stimulation. All right. And our response is what happens to your SA node? Fires faster, heart rate increases, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what about blood pressure?
It increases.
And how do we increase blood pressure?
By vasoconstriction.
Good, get those vessels to squeeze. How'd you do with that first one? Pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. Our next one the next three are all chemoreceptor related. So our next one talks about high blood pH or an alkalosis condition. So that, in fact, is our stimulus. The problem here is alkalosis. Just to make sure we're covering our bases, what does that mean in terms of pH?
It is high, 7.45.
Yeah, high above 7.45, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the type of receptor that picks up on a chemistry issue is?
Chemoreceptor,
good. Now, what does your brain, your control center, say we should do about this problem? Decrease sympathetic stimulation and increase parasympathetic stimulation. And the thing we're sticking in the back of our brains, there is no parasympathetic innervation to
the vessels.
Yeah. All right, so we decrease parasympathetic increase. That said it backwards, didn't I?
Yeah.
Increase parasympathetic, decrease sympathetic. Okay, so what happens to heart rate?
It drops.
It drops, and blood pressure
also drops.
Good. This is probably obvious, but I'll say it anyway. When blood pressure goes up, what does heart rate do? Goes up. And when blood pressure goes down, there goes heart rate. So they're hand in hand. So your job is not to figure out which one is up or down. They're doing it together. So that may make your job a little easier.
So that's the effect, is it drop blood pressure and heart rate?
Yeah, drops blood pressure and heart rate, yeah. Let's see. Hypercapnia is just fancy language for too much CO2. And we've got another issue there of acidosis. Either way, what kind of receptor picks up on this?
Chemoreceptor,
good. So our stimulus is two. It's increased carbon dioxide and acidosis. Of course, the receptors are chemo. The control center says increase what?
Sympathetic
stimulation and decrease
parasympathetic.
Good. And of course, the effectors are SA node and vessels. So what does the SA node do to the heart? Increase heart rate. And what about the vessels?
They constrict.
They constrict. Good. So vessels constrict, blood pressure will increase. So we did this mountain trip. We did the hypoxia issue. We know that hypoxia is the stimulus. In fancy language, what is hypoxia?
Low oxygen.
Low oxygen, good. And what type of receptor detects this problem?
Chemoreceptors.
Chemoreceptors. The brain makes a decision to do what?
Oh, increase the sympathetic stimulation.
Increase sympathetic stimulation. And so, yeah, again, decrease
parasympathetic,
that's right. All right, what happens to heart rate and blood pressure?
They go up.
Good.
So decrease parasympathetic.
Decrease parasympathetic, yeah. Let's see, if you would like more of these practice problems, I've got them in two locations for you. This is a blood vessel number 2 PowerPoint. This is in D2L in the content area. What I've got is a scenario and a response. So you can work through, I think I've got 6 of these up here that you can play with. I also took these out of the PowerPoint, put them in a document. I gave you the page of the problems. The second page are the answers. And those should be loaded in the announcements area. I'll double check when I get back to my office. But there's another place where you can grab the very same practice problems. How do you feel about this stuff? Not bad? Okay, that's good. Yeah. Once you have to work it out, and that's why I think these scenarios will help you. All right, so we've actually covered the neural control of blood pressure. Let's talk about a couple of other things that can influence blood pressure. Chemical control and hormonal control. And they're going to be over on page 56. Sure.
So the chemoreceptors, and the control mechanism always, if it increases sympathetic, it's going to always decrease parasympathetic.
Always, yep. So these are some chemicals that can influence your blood pressure, and you actually make histamine. Basophils, you may recall, have little granules of histamine that they can release into your vessels. Histamine happens to be a pretty potent vasodilator, and that means that your blood pressure will decrease in response to the presence of histamine. Nitrous oxide is something else that your vessels make. Nitrous oxide will also cause your vessels to dilate. Blood pressure will drop. You may have heard of nitrous before. They call it laughing gas at the dentist office. It makes you very relaxed. But it's important to put a pulse oximeter on your finger because the pulse oximeter not only detects your pulse rate, but it also detects how much oxygen is flowing through the vessels in your finger. So why is this important for us to do?
Make sure we're getting enough oxygen throughout the body.
Yeah, because if your blood pressure drops too low, what is the risk we run?
Fainting.
Yeah, not getting enough oxygen to your brain. Yeah, so of course we want to make sure we know this before we cause problems. You may have heard of huffing before. Okay, so the problem with this is you're getting unregulated amounts of nitrous oxide. The rush comes when oxygen hits your brain after having huffed nitrous off of some kind of canister. Well, you know, at least with laughing gas at the dentist office, you're getting a prescribed dose that's coming through that mask. But with huffing, you're getting perhaps a massive dose one time, not a very big dose the next time. And this can ultimately lead to oxygen deprivation from your brain and brain damage.
Okay. Is that why
you're telling
you have to suck the
heat in
the
other
room?
Totally different, yeah. Nicotine is something that we don't make, but it is a chemical that can influence our blood pressure. It's found in tobacco products. It happens to be a pretty potent vasoconstrictor. So we've checked off neural control of blood pressure. We've talked about some chemicals. That certainly was not a comprehensive list, but at least it gave us some ideas to think about. And then our last thing here is hormonal control of blood pressure. We've actually been here already back in our first chapter, so let me just make sure I got the blanks filled in for you. All right, so these should be four familiar friends. We've got epinephrine and norepinephrine. We know that both of those will increase blood pressure. We know, of course, that beta blockers are drugs that block the effects of epinephrine on your heart. And so what happens to your heart rate when you take a beta blocker? Slows it down, exactly. The next one there is antidiuretic hormone. It causes water retention. Because we retain water thanks to ADH, what happens to blood pressure when ADH is present?
It increases,
right. I should mention here that ADH doesn't really have a direct influence over your heart. It can increase blood pressure through water retention. So I've got a question written there for you. It says, why do you think a person might receive vasopressin, which is an alternate name for ADH, rather than epinephrine as a way to increase blood pressure? What does epinephrine do to your heart?
Slows it down.
So epinephrine does what to your blood pressure?
Increases.
Let's say we've got somebody who has low blood pressure and a failing heart that we don't necessarily want to cause the rate to increase. Is epinephrine a good bet for that patient?
No.
No, because we can end up wearing their heart out. So if you just want to increase blood pressure, now what's your better choice?
Vasopressin,
right. It only increases blood pressure. It does not increase directly the heart rate. Okay, so that answer there is it ADH or vasopressin only increases blood pressure. Only increases blood pressure, does not directly increase heart rate. Does not directly increase heart rate. So you may have heard of angiotensin II. It was part of our renin-angiotensin mechanism back when we covered hormones. This particular one is a strong vasoconstrictor. You'll notice another thing there, asking about ACE inhibitors. That prevents the formation of angiotensin II. So why might someone take an ACE inhibitor?
To lower blood pressure.
To lower blood pressure, exactly. And of course, ACE inhibitors will also block the formation of aldosterone. We'll get more into the details of that later in the kidney chapter. All right, so that answer there is, of course, we are looking at lowering blood pressure. ACE inhibitors lower blood pressure. Do you remember what ANP does for your blood pressure?
Decreases it, yeah.
So looking at this list, pretty much everything here, epinephrine, norepinephrine, ADH, angiotensin II, all increase blood pressure. The only hormone that we've got on this list to decrease blood pressure is atrial natriuretic peptide, or ANP. So you may want to put a little star beside that one. It is the lone wolf in terms of decreasing blood pressure. So during our last bit of time today, what I'd like to do is introduce to you the information that's found on page 58 and leave for you page 59 as a homework page.
How about questions on anything we've covered so far today? So the last topic with blood vessels has to do with something called bulk fluid transport at a capillary, okay? And so first of all, I want to reemphasize why capillaries are an ideal location for the bulk fluid transport of fluids. What is it about the nature of a capillary structure that makes it well built for this job?
It has only one tunic layer.
One tunic layer, and that tunic is?
Is it
intima? Intima, yeah.
Okay.
And it's made up of a layer of simple squamous. Good. A lot of our capillaries are considered to be fenestrated, which means they've got openings or pores between the adjacent simple squamous cells. And so it makes it easy for fluids to be forced between those cells out into the surrounding interstitial fluid. Speaking of fluid, let's go over here on the other side of the board and talk about the two major fluid compartments. You may have seen this way back in Bio-210. The number one storage location for fluids is intracellular, and that means it's where?
Inside
the cells. So in fact, that is around 2/3 of our fluids. If I remember the number correctly, it's something like we tote around, I think it's 20 to 25 liters of fluid. That's a lot of fluid that we tote around in total, and so most of that is housed inside of our cells as intracellular fluid. ECF, what does that stand for?
Extracellular.
That's about a third of our fluids. There's a lot of extracellular fluids in our bodies. You know, the fluid in your eye is extracellular. The fluid in your lymphatic system is extracellular. But the two main extracellular fluids we want to focus on are plasma and our bloodstream. That's around, 2.5 liters? We can just make it simple. That's about 0.5 liters. And what is IF?
Interstitial.
Yeah, interstitial fluid, and that's found outside cells and tissues, not inside. Okay, so these are the two primary extracellular compartments we're going to be focusing on. When we talk about bulk fluid transport at capillaries, we're talking about how fluids are shifted from your bloodstream into your interstitial fluids, into your cells, and then back into the bloodstream. So we're mainly talking right now about the fluid shift that occurs between your capillaries and surrounding cells and tissues. We are not talking about nutrients, waste products, gas exchange, or any of that stuff. We'll pick up on some of that later on. All right, so far so good. Let me introduce the two battling pressures. I feel like I'm, in WWE here. In this corner, we've got blood hydrostatic pressure. Okay. And in the other corner, we've got blood osmotic pressure. All right, so we've got two battling pressures here. And, of course, hydrostatic pressure is one we're already familiar with. We call it BHP for short. And, of course, hydro means what?
Water.
Water. This is blood pressure. I wish they would pick names and go with it, right? Okay, this is a time where they up and switch the names on us, and so blood hydrostatic pressure and blood pressure are the exact same thing. They're the fluid pressure created by blood plasma. Talking about your heart creating blood pressure, that force of contraction pushes blood through your vessels. push, that is the key word. Hydrostatic pressure, or just simply blood pressure, is a pushy pressure, okay? And so it's going to be forcing the fluid in your bloodstream against the walls of those capillaries. The second pressure in our battle is called osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure should ring a bell. Kind of sounds like osmosis, right? Okay, so thinking back to osmosis, in our discussions of osmosis, we always said to you, hey, water follows salt, right? So in the case of osmotic pressure, it is the salts and proteins in your bloodstream that create osmotic pressure. So you'll notice in the bloodstream picture down there, I've got salts and proteins floating through your blood plasma. Those create pulling power that attract water to the capillary. All right, so let's kind of contrast this. Osmotic pressure is created by salts or solutes and proteins. Pressure happens to pull fluids, not pushes them.
It's just the going in and out type of thing.
Yeah. One's pushing out, one's pulling in. Yeah. Let me emphasize once again that blood hydrostatic pressure is based on fluid in your bloodstream, basically your blood plasma that's pushing against the walls of your capillaries. It is a pushy pressure. Osmotic pressure is based on salts and proteins in your bloodstream. We know that water loves to travel to the higher salt or solute concentration, so higher osmotic pressure has pulling power. So we're going to look at key terms here like push and pull, because that's the battle we've got set up. We've got a pressure that pushes fluids, and we have a battling pressure that pulls fluids. I need to make sure this makes good sense before we take the next step. Is there anything I need to clarify for you? Fluid compartments, these two battling pressures. Well, our battle is set, so let's go to our picture of the capillary. All right, so let me explain what we've got here. We've got the arterial end at the left of the picture. This is a capillary. And here we have the venule end on the right side. We know that blood flows from arteries to arterioles to capillaries to venules back to veins. So we're just watching blood flow through this capillary. We know that we've got very small capillaries. They're about the size for a red blood cell to travel through single file. We also know the capillary is made up of simple squamous tissue. That makes it easy for us to push fluids out to the surrounding interstitial space. We've got some fluids here to pay attention to. We've got a pretty solute-rich fluid inside your capillary. These are my little solutes floating through. Out here in the interstitial space, you'll notice there's hardly any solutes. And this interstitial space is actually a type of extracellular fluid. The most of our fluids are actually stored where?
Intracellular,
yeah. So we're going to watch how fluids are pushed and pulled. Let me start you off down here on the arterial end of our capillary, and let me give you the blood hydrostatic value. Now, I do want to say up front, you guys do not have to memorize numbers for the test. If they happen to stick in your brain, that's great, but I'm not going to say to you, what is the value for this particular pressure? I'm more interested in you getting the actual push-pull relationship and which pressure is responsible for pushing out fluids versus which pressure is responsible for pulling in fluids. So down here at this arterial end of your capillary, we're looking at a blood pressure or a blood hydrostatic pressure of around 35 millimeters mercury.
That's not too healthy, is it? That's not like 120 coming off of an aorta, but it's got some push behind it. Okay. The blood osmotic pressure happens to be 22 or 26 rather millimeters mercury. All right, it's really easy. The higher number wins the battle. So are we pushing fluids or are we pulling fluids at the arterial end?
We're pushing.
Blood hydrostatic pressure is a pushing pressure. Blood osmotic pressure is a pulling pressure. So, yeah, blood hydrostatic pressure wins the battle, and it forces fluids out into your interstitial space. Because this is a pressure that's pushing these fluids, we're not going to call it osmosis. Instead, we have a different name. What do we call it? When you push fluids out, it's called filtration. Yeah, it's called filtration. So which pressure is responsible for filtration? Yeah, blood hydrostatic pressure. It is the one created by fluids in your capillary. It's a pushing pressure, and it forces fluids out into your interstitial space. I have a mental image of capillaries looking like those garden hoses, you know, the ones that have a bunch of holes poked in them that you lay around in your garden, and they basically leak fluid to your garden. Well, that's what happens with the capillary. They leak fluids out here to the interstitial space. Thank you to high hydrostatic pressure. Well, if you took any kind of hose and you poked holes in it and you turn the water at full force, eventually all your fluids are going to leak out, right? And by the time you get to the end of the hose, you may be staying there with nothing but a trickle of water coming out the other end. That is exactly what happens here. By the time you get down here toward the venule end of your capillary, we're going to start losing our hydrostatic pressure. Where's all the fluid going?
Into the
interstitial fluids, yeah. So when you reach the other end of the capillary, we're looking at a rather low hydrostatic pressure. It's about 15 to 17 millimeters mercury. So we've pushed a lot of the fluids out. We've lost the pushing pressure. But this is interesting. You haven't stayed the same. You haven't changed your solutes and your proteins. So osmotic pressure does stay the same. Good. Well, the higher pressure wins the battle. The higher number is 26 this time. And so this time we're looking at a pulling pressure. So osmotic pressure down here at this end of the capillary is going to start pulling fluids back into your capillary. This is called what?
Reabsorption.
Good. You know, there is actually a little bit of hydrostatic and osmotic pressure in your interstitial space. They are less than 1 millimeter mercury of pressure. So I just want to mention that so you know they're there, but they're not going to be part of our conversation. The real battle over the pressures is here in the capillary, the push of hydrostatic versus the pull of osmotic. So when we talk about a net filtration pressure, an overall push value or a pull value, we actually take into consideration those very small hydrostatic and osmotic pressures in the interstitial space. The reason I mention that is because on your worksheet, down below on page 58, do you see something that says NFP? Okay, that stands for net filtration pressure. It happens to be 10 at the arterial end and negative 8 at the venule end. The reason I mention this is because if you do the math, 35 minus 26 is not 10. And you think, well, how in the world did they come up with 10 as the overall push? They take into consideration these very small hydrostatic and osmotic pressures in the interstitial space. So it's not truly bad math. It's just you got to consider those two small pressures. All right, so now we're about out of time. What I'd like to ask you to do is take a look at page 59 as homework. If you can work through those, I'll be happy to go over answers with you in class on Thursday. We'll then hit lymphatic system, and then we'll give some time for upcoming Q&A for the test.